All right, thank you. So the title of my talk is New Ideas for the Composition of Dark Matter. I actually can't take credit for the title. I have to give credit to Andreas Kronfeld, who's one of our program organizers, for what he called a punny title. So in fact, what I'm going to be talking about is mainly new ideas, but the basic idea is actually fairly old, goes back to the late 80s, and the idea is composite dark matter, so composite composition. So here's my basic plan for this talk. I'm going to start with some motivation, tell you a little bit about what we know already about dark matter, the ways we sort of look for traditional WIMP dark matter, just to set the stage, and then I'll go into the idea of composite dark matter and how that might be different from the traditional sort of vanilla WIMP dark matter that we're used to thinking about. And here I'll go through a few different things at varying levels of detail. The most important thing to get right is the stability, as dark matter has to be stable, and to get the right relic density. I'll talk about signatures in colliders, in so-called indirect detection experiments, and I'll explain what that means in a minute if you're not familiar with it. And then finally, the subject I'll have the most to say about, direct detection. So searching directly for dark matter. This is a Blackboard talk, so usually when I talk about this subject, it's sort of an active field. There's a lot of people doing interesting work. I like to give a lot of references. Since it's a Blackboard talk, I didn't want to be writing down archive numbers and references all the time. So I'm going to mostly play fast and loose with them during the talk. If you look on the program wiki for the Lattice QCD program, later, say this evening, I will upload a list of references that you can look at. Okay. So, start with motivation. It's basic evidence for the existence of dark matter. Everyone just sat down, opened their lunch, so I'll start slow. We don't know much about particle dark matter, but at this point we at least have very strong evidence that it's out there, and that's even the dominant component of the matter in our universe. And the first evidence really comes from the observed motion of things that we can see from stars and galaxies out there, and comparing to what we'd expect from just Newtonian gravity based on the matter that we can see. So I can start with some basic classical mechanics. If I have a distribution of matter with some density rho, then the gravitational field that's generated by it I can write down using Gauss's law, the area integral over the surface of some volume, equal to minus 4 pi g integral of the density. And the usual story, if you take a spherical shell as the surface of integration, the left-hand side just gives us the surface area of the sphere. And if the density is a point mass, and this is just m, and you recover the usual 1 over r squared force law, very simply. Mm over r squared. And if I want to compare this to the motion, if I want to look at the motion, one of the easiest things to look at is the velocity of some star or some galaxy out there, determined from the redshift or so forth. And so I can infer the velocity from here. It will drop as 1 over the square root of r for s. On the other hand, if I'm looking inside, say, the core of a galaxy, if I have, say, constant density in a spherical distribution of stars, then the mass enclosed on the right side grows as r cubed. The gravitational force is proportional to r, and the velocity goes as r, so increases. Of course, if I'm going to look out in the real world at something like a spiral galaxy, that's a significantly more complicated thing. I can still do the calculation. I won't necessarily do it on the blackboard. But the basic point to make here is that that will hold even for more complicated object is that if we're sort of within the density, deep within the density, the velocity, orbital velocity will increase. And if we look far outside, it decreases. A simple observation. And of course, as everyone probably knows already, what we see doesn't match the expectations. So if I take some observed galaxy out there, and this is from some spiral galaxy. I look at the distribution of stars that I see, and I basically project what the orbital velocity of the star should be as I look outward in radius from the center. I get something like this. And then if I actually go to measure what the distribution is, it will sort of follow this for a while, and I'll find something that sort of grows or goes to a constant at a large radius. Even for the most distant visible stars in the galaxy, the velocity just stays flat or keeps growing. And so that tells you the simplest explanation is just that the distribution of matter goes out much further than you can actually see. And this has been verified. This is not visible in every galaxy, but it's been verified in a wide range of galaxies, even in the one which is hardest to observe, which is our own, the Milky Way. Observations of the most distant stars compared to basically just counting up the number of stars in the galaxy gives a discrepancy in mass of about a factor of 2 to 5. If I only wanted to explain this effect, the rotation curves, there are alternate explanations available, of course. I can try to play with modifying gravity in some way that would explain this. And I can do a pretty good job for a lot of rotation curves, but at this point, there is a lot more evidence, which is harder to explain in a unified way in some framework like that. And I'll just give you the bullet points here. Gravitational lensing lets us infer the presence of mass distributions that we can't actually see. And there are famous observations, for example, of the bullet cluster, where we can see a collision of two large galaxies, and there's an offset between the visible mass distribution, which collides with each other and interacts strongly, and with the inferred mass distribution from lensing, which is kind of kept going. We can look at large-scale structure. The sort of web-like structure of our universe on the very largest scales is very, very well reproduced by a simulational model, just n-body simulation, where you put in nothing but cold dark matter, essentially. You reproduce very closely what our universe looks like. And the most quantitative evidence comes from the cosmic microwave background, looking at the power spectrum. You can back out what the amount of matter is versus radiation in the early universe from the fluctuations, the acoustic oscillations in the CMB. And this gives us the best numerical evidence. So omega dark matter, that's the abundance of dark matter in the universe as a percentage. This is about 26%. Omega B is about 5%. Okay. So everything I've talked about so far, all this evidence comes purely from gravitational effects. So the only thing we know at this point is that dark matter interacts gravitationally. But there's really good motivation for there to be some other interaction between dark matter and us and the Standard Model, and that comes from these two numbers. So there's what we call a relic density coincidence, basically that these numbers are pretty close to each other. A factor of 5 is pretty close. You know, they didn't have to be within the same order of magnitude as each other. And so this motivates some connection in the early universe between the dark sector and us. So if I assume that dark matter is there and that it talks to the Standard Model somehow, there are three basic approaches we can take to search for it, which I can visualize with one big Feynman diagram. So I have some blob which symbolizes shows the interaction. I have dark matter coming in and going out. Standard Model on the other side. And something happens in here. So if I think about this in terms of crossing symmetry, basically I can run the process in different directions and find different ways to look for this interaction. Horizontally, I have dark matter scattering off of the Standard Model. This is what we call direct detection. This way is indirect detection. This is annihilation of dark matter with itself to produce Standard Model particles. So we look out in the universe with gamma ray telescopes and so forth for that. And then finally, we can go the other way. We can start with Standard Model states in a collider and just try to produce dark matter. Let me say a little bit about each of these. So direct detection, we have a big tank of something on the Earth, usually a big tank of some relatively heavy nuclear material deep underground to reduce the backgrounds. And this will give me a rate, a predicted, I can write down the formula for the predicted rate of dark matter collisions that the experiment will observe. So I have mass of the detector over the mass of the target, density of dark matter over mass of dark matter. This is the number density of everything involved, basically. Integral from Emin to Emax. So integral over the recoil energy, I have a factor called the acceptance. And finally, thermally averaged cross-section. Okay, so these ingredients, there are some obvious things you can do if you want to make a better detector, right? So increasing the mass, having better acceptance are sort of obvious improvements. But the scaling is sort of trivial. All the subtle dependence is in this last term, which depends on the nature of the dark matter interaction with us, so that cross-section, that information is contained in there. Also on the properties of the nuclear target, which is usually some kind of heavy nucleus, so those properties can be kind of tricky, depending on exactly what the interaction is. And finally, this is a thermal average, so we have to know what the distribution of dark matter in the universe is, what the halo model is. I won't talk much about that. That's something which is interesting to look at variations of, but is sort of orthogonal to exactly what the details of the cross-section are for the most part. So I'm going to focus on models that sort of do interesting things to the cross-section. Okay. So many of you have probably seen the canonical way that this is presented, which is this sort of direct detection, the standard plot, where I take the dark matter mass, I have some cross-section here, which is called the nucleon cross-section. I get these nice curves. I can keep drawing curves on here. There's a number of different experiments. Some of them have claimed detection, so I can draw bubbles for possible signals. I could draw theory blobs on here. I could draw something really horrible and complicated. I won't do that. I'll draw a specific version of this plot later. But if you're not used to staring at these things, it just look like a mess anyway. However, I'll point out that if you are used to seeing these plots, there's an important assumption that goes into this. And that assumption is basically this. Is replacing that blob with essentially Higgs exchange. But in particular, as I said, this interaction depends in detail on exactly what this target is, what the nucleus is on the other side. And it's very hard to project things onto a single plane for many different nuclear targets unless you make some assumption about what the interaction is. And this is sort of the simplest assumption. This gives you a cross-section that just scales with the mass number squared and just interacts coherently with the nucleus. So the scaling with different targets is very easy. It's a nice way to project everything onto a single plane and say, I want to compare two different targets and so forth. But you should keep in mind whenever you see these plots that assumption has been made. And if you had a different kind of interaction, something different mediating this, then the exclusions could move around. And maybe two experiments that were in tension before might not be anymore. Okay, so I'm not going to try to draw detailed plots of this with numbers at the moment. Suffice it to say that these bounds are very strong at the moment. Dark matter is very dark. Even something like tree-level Z exchange has been ruled out for many orders of magnitude at this point, what you might expect for relic neutrino dark matter, for example. I just wanted to emphasize the dependence on targets. Okay. Let me do indirect detection next. A few words about that. So that's very interesting because it gives you sort of a direct insight into the distribution of dark matter in the universe. Once you find a signal, you can really look out in the sky and see how it's distributed. The downside of this channel is that the backgrounds from astrophysics are pretty complicated, and some of them are not well understood. And to actually back out the dark matter properties, again, you need to make some model assumptions. In particular, I've assumed here even in drawing this diagram, that I have some simple interaction where it's just two dark matter particles going in, two standard model particles coming out. You can further assume that this is exactly the same thing that's responsible for connecting those number densities in the early universe. But of course, you could imagine a much more complicated model where you get a bunch of things. So you get three dark matter particles out that are different ones. They're unstable. They decay into a bunch of standard model stuff. This is a variation on that simple 2 to 2 that would sort of drastically change what you might infer about the dark matter from any signal that you see. And as these experiments, which are also getting more sensitive, continue to push to better bounds, if they push into the region, in particular, the relic density cross-section, where you get these numbers right and they don't see anything, it becomes more interesting to think about variations like this. So finally, the third line I drew in there was for colliders. And this is pretty direct and controlled, so I have just at the LHC of proton-proton collision, for example, I make some dark matter. And the most generic thing you can do to search for this is just to say, well, the dark matter itself, we know it doesn't interact with us very strongly, it's going to escape the detector. So this will be missing energy. I just have to radiate something, like a photon or a gluon from the initial state, something to trigger on for this to recoil against, and then I can measure that this was there. And this is very nice. There are great experimental searches for these sorts of channels, monophoton, monogluon, mono anything you can think of. And they have really robust and, to a degree, model-independent bounds on dark matter. But we can do better if we have a particular model. So for some dark matter models, in particular anything that's sort of more complicated, where there's a number of states aside from just the dark matter sitting nearby in energy, we may be better to look for those states instead. So for supersymmetric dark matter, for example, there are a lot of charged states that exist at the electroweak scale in addition to the dark matter candidate, and we can go looking for those directly in the collider and usually do better. Okay. So those are the three different channels that we hope to look for dark matter. I sort of gave you a little bit of the standard story for how we do it, and then kind of hinted at some interesting variations that we might consider that might challenge the usual assumptions. And that brings me to the main point of the talk, the main thing I want to talk about, composite dark matter. And I want to convince you that this is a model construction that can give us a concrete motivation to look for many of these effects, these sort of interesting variations on what we might see in these experiments. Any of the effects I'm going to discuss here are not necessarily unique to composite dark matter, but again, this is sort of a concrete motivation to look for the things I'm going to talk about. So I should explain what I mean by composite dark matter. For me, composite is going to mean, for the purposes of this talk, a strongly coupled bound state. So I have in mind, and you should have in the back of your mind, something like the neutron. So I have some fundamental particles. They are themselves charged. They're bound into some bound state. This is some ball of gluons that I can't really draw. You know, that's one Feynman diagram of an infinite number. But the point is I have some very strongly bound state. These things carry charges on their own, but when taken as a whole, the net charge is zero. And this is the idea for dark matter. Again, we know dark matter has to be pretty dark. It has to be net neutral under all the standard model forces. But it can have constituents that carry charges. This is not the most general possible use of this term. Certainly, there are possibilities like dark atoms, even something like a Kaluza-Klein resonance, you could argue is sort of a composite dark matter state, or could be. But that's beyond the scope of what I want to talk about. I want to focus on this sort of concrete realization, which will connect me to lattice as well, which is a great way to calculate in theories that gives rise to these things. So,
but just to be clear, you do not mean the neutron.
I do not mean the actual neutron.
You do not mean the up quark or the down quarks.
Yes, the neutron is an example. So the neutron is a bad dark matter candidate because although it's neutral under the photon, this has a net charge with respect to the Z boson.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes.
Is this just a model, or is there actual evidence in the data that requires you to think of it as a bound, some bound state?
This is just a model. I'm going to talk about what some of the evidence for something like this could be.
Okay.
But this is just a model. Sort of, as I said, this is mainly to motivate. When you look at this model, a lot of the qualitative properties in all of these three searches turn out to be sort of interesting and I think worth thinking about.
When you say dark, it means that there's no electromagnetic interaction. Is it clear that it doesn't have strong or weak interaction?
So the particle, the dark matter candidate, cannot have any net charge under any of those interactions. So as I said, the weakest interaction basically would be a net charge under the Z, and that's been ruled out by many orders of magnitude by the experiments at this point. What I will tell you is that the constituents can carry charges, and then they will give rise to an interaction for the whole, which is weaker than a tree level interaction. So as I said, this is not, I'm going to give you some new ideas. This basic idea is not new. This is actually popularized in the context of...
Tie back to the question. That,
yes.
That's why people assume the Higgs boson in that graph over there, because anything less exotic would be ruled out, but it could be something more exotic than Higgs.
Right, like some new particle. Sure.
So through the motivation, it's easy to come up with dark matter that doesn't interact with anything, we'll never be able to see it.
Yes,
it's nice to come up with ideas that we can design experiments around and maybe someday they'll be discovered.
Yes, exactly. And that's, you know, the point I want to make here is that this is something that has interesting signatures you can go look for. But yes, as I said at the beginning, this coincidence motivates us to have some interaction. Us in the dark.
Before
you
go into that, can I ask
yes.
a question? So infinity is the only object which is there. Sometimes in drawing those limits, they are distinguishing between spin-dependent and spin-independent interaction. How
yes.
do we enter into the picture?
Okay, so I should clarify, this is one of the two canonical plots that people tend to show for dark matter exclusions. This is the spin-independent plot, and that's the one that makes this assumption. Spin-dependent just assumes some kind of coupling which couples to the spin of the nucleus instead of the coherently to the whole nucleus. So the bounds tend to be significantly weaker because of that, so it's not coherent. Okay. So as I was saying, this is not itself a new idea. This was sort of popularized in the late 80s in the context of Technicolor models, which are models for electroweak symmetry breaking, which would replace the Higgs mechanism, or replace the Higgs, but which have sort of baryon states naturally, which could serve as dark matter candidates, baryon-like states. Okay. So what does it mean to have a composite state? There are two sort of generic signatures of a composite particle. The first is what I'll call form factors. And what I mean by that is just that the couplings of the whole particle will be momentum dependent. So as for the neutron, if I try to scatter a photon off of the neutron, the real neutron, at zero momentum, there's no interaction, but if I give this photon more and more momentum, it will eventually start probing the internal degrees of freedom here. It will scatter off of the quarks inside of it, effectively. And so if I can write down a vertex for the neutron with the photon, and it will have some coupling which is strongly dependent on the momentum. And I'll go into more detail into exactly what that coupling looks like in a bit. But that's the basic point, is that a composite state has some internal structure that you can probe if you hit it hard enough, basically. The second generic signature that you're dealing with a composite state is the presence of excited states, so specifically excitations basically of internal degrees of freedom of the particle. So you'd see states which are identical except for some increase in energy, for example. You'd see a lot of states which are different configurations of the constituents, like a proton versus a neutron, for example. So generically, there are going to be a lot of charged states in our composite dark matter sector, even if the dark matter candidate itself is neutral. And those will be very important in the early universe and in some of these searches. So a major disadvantage, as I said, of these theories is that they're very strongly coupled. We can't really use perturbation theory reliably to do a lot of things, but techniques like lattice can play a major role. And I'll try to highlight where lattice has come into to tell us things about composite dark matter already as I go along. Okay. Let me go into stability. So I can start by sketching roughly the spectrum of a theory, a strongly coupled theory we know very well, which is QCD. So if I take the mass, this is just some generic x-axis, I have a pion, kaon, this is going to be an excerpt of the actual spectrum, rho, neutron and proton are up here, lambda, I can keep going. I could draw many, many states on here. I have more on the actual plot I'm looking at. There's a lot of resonances. Again, this is one of the signatures of compositeness. There's a huge number of excited states. Many of them have the same quantum numbers. And we have to deal with stability. Basically, there's only a few choices that can give us a stable dark matter candidate. Because all these things are strongly coupled. All these things are coupled under QCD, and most of them have strong interaction decays where they'll go down to lighter states. So we have to look at the lightest available state, unless there's some symmetry that will keep things stable for us. That restricts us to either this one, lightest meson, or this one, which is the baryon. Of course, the pion is not stable in QCD due to weak interactions, but we can construct easily a dark sector that has a similar spectrum where the lightest meson would be stable just by assigning the charges to the standard model in the right way. And the nucleon, of course, is stabilized by what we call an accidental symmetry. So to say a little bit more about that, I can just write down just think in terms of effective field theory and write down what the operators are that would mediate the decay. So for the meson, a meson is a bound state of some fermion psi and psi bar. It's always a two-component bound state. It's a single number of gauge interactions. This object, the nucleon, is a bound state of three of n. If I have an SUN gauge theory, there are n components in there. There's three for the neutron and proton. And so if I write down an operator that will let these things decay for the meson, I need to have a psi bar psi, where psi is the constituent, and then I can write down something very generic like, say, H dagger H, where that's the Higgs field. So this operator is dimension 5. It will be suppressed by some high scale, but it's only suppressed by one power of the high scale. On the other hand, for the baryon, I can try, again, this one of the simplest things I can write down is just H dagger H, but then I need to write down an operator which overlaps with the baryon. And as I said, I need N of these things. So this is more and more stable as I increase the value of N, the size of the gauge group, V1 over lambda to some higher power. And in fact, any such operator I could try to write down that would overlap with a baryon, especially as n increases, they become more and more heavily suppressed just because they're higher and higher dimension in the effective field theory. And so this is what I mean when I say that the baryon is accidentally stable. Basically, all the operators you would try to write down to make it decay are highly suppressed. You can build realistic dark matter models using the meson, but you have to sort of worry about this thing. Even if I put the Planck mass, sort of the heaviest scale I'd be willing to put in there, as the cutoff scale, that's not really going to be stable on the cosmological timescale that I need it to be. So to avoid that complication, I'm going to focus on baryons for what I say.
But that means that, yes. I mean, if this were real, that the meson-like particles would decay. early in the universe, or not so early, but they'd be gone by now, but the baryons would survive because they're much longer life.
Generically, yes. And that's if you want the baryon to be your dark matter candidate, that's a good feature, I would argue. That's a helpful feature. If you want this will be the only remaining candidate. I'm not saying that the meson models don't work. I mean, they're out there. People have written them down. You just have to argue against the existence of those operators like that one in some way. It's easier to work with the baryons. I will just mention in passing. Well, let me skip that because I think I'm starting to run out of time. You can imagine a third kind of state, which is called a glue ball, but I'm not going to go into it. That could probably be its own talk. All right. Let me come to relic density. So with that basic motivation, I'm going to focus on baryons. So how do we get the right amount of them? So the usual way that this works, as I said, there are two ways. One is called the thermal relic mechanism, and the usual way this works is I have some, effectively, a heat bath of standard model states, and my dark sector is connected to them with some interaction, and they will sort of be, the abundance will be determined by this interaction. They will stay in thermal equilibrium until some point set by this cross section at which the dark matter sort of freezes out, stops interacting with the universe, and that fixes the density of it. It so happens that you get the right density to give us the right relic density if it has sort of a weak scale interaction with us, which is the WIMP miracle. For composite dark matter, the story tends to be more complicated. So the dark matter itself is going to have very weak interactions with the standard model. In particular, it's going to have much stronger interactions with the other states in the composite sector, which I'll call charged composites. So this interaction will be very strong. This interaction will also be much stronger than the direct interaction between dark matter and standard model. Again, because these things are charged. And strong and weak here are just relative magnitudes relative to each other. So what happens is that you sort of decouple two different things. You decouple this cross-section that the standard model interacts with the dark matter from the one that sets the relic density, which really turns out to be this one. So how does it work? Well, I can draw a plot. Of the number density versus time in the early universe. So time is 1 over temperature for me in the early universe. This is some up to some normalization, the number density in a co-moving volume. And this is my standard model heat bath. The number density is declining exponentially. And I'm going to have these charged dark matter states. We'll split off at some point here. But then they're unstable. As I said, the baryons are stable. These states, mostly the meson states, are not stable, and they will decay away. So effectively, these things are tracing along this heat bath with the standard model. And so the interactions of the real dark matter, the neutral guy, with these things is setting this freeze out, the relic density of those. So it's decoupling this scale from the interaction from where it would decouple if you didn't have the charged guys. Which one tends to point you to sort of different regions of the parameter space that you might not think about if you were thinking about a standard WIMP, and two, decouples this cross-section from indirect detection, from where you might look for this directly in the current universe. There's another possibility, which is that this is an asymmetric relic, but again, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip past that. I'll just say that that was sort of the original mechanism that people envisioned for these models in the context of Technicolor, of composite Higgs. Okay. Let me come to collider signatures. So, as I mentioned, it can be more efficient if you have a particular model of dark matter, like the one that I have, to look for some of the other states, the complementary states, instead of just the dark matter candidate itself. And this is especially true for these composite dark baryon states, because they're not the lightest state in the dark sector. So if you'll notice, and this tends to be true, QCD is a little bit of a special case, of course, because this, the pion, is a goldstone, a pseudo-goldstone boson, so its mass is much lighter than the nucleon mass, just because the quark masses are light, much lighter than the scale, the sort of confinement scale that sets the rest of these masses. But in general, just because of this tendency that the baryon will be made up of more fermions than the meson will, there's a tendency for this state to be much heavier. And so it's actually, unlike, say, supersymmetric dark matter, where the dark matter candidate is the lightest state in the spectrum, you really get a lot more leverage by looking directly for these light charge states instead of looking for the dark matter directly as missing energy. Okay. So we can actually say a lot about what the meson decay. So I want to go look for these things in the collider. What are the signatures of them? We can say a lot about it without appealing too much to a particular strongly coupled model. So again, these things I'm always going to write as some bound state of two of these fermions, which I'm writing as capital Psi. So that's a charged guy, for example. And we can look at the decay essentially as self-annihilation of the components of it. So if these things carry electroweak charge, I can annihilate into a W boson, and that will produce some standard model particles at the end here. And I can write down the decay width very generally. For this to happen, I have some factors from the weak interaction. F pi squared is the decay constant, measures how tightly bound the state is, in essence. That comes from the strongly coupled theory. Mf squared, C axial squared, and then some kinematic factor, which I will skip over. This is a model-dependent parameter that basically measures the overlap of this current with the weak current in the standard model. So that's a number between 0 and 1. We don't have to get into the details. The most important part of this formula is that scaling. So the decay width is actually proportional to the mass of the final state particle squared. And what that means is that the decay always goes preferentially to whatever the heaviest state available is. So that's a signature of these composite states that are annihilating in this way, that they go to the heaviest states kinematically allowed. So this leads to a very robust bound from LEP. So LEP was basically able to produce particles up to, say, 90 GeV or so, and it would produce them in the B plus E minus collision. These charged things are particularly easy to make just by making a photon and having it go to them. So the amount of these you would have made at the LEP experiment would have been quite large, and we know the decay goes to the heaviest available thing, so partly charm and strange in this mass region. Less than 90 GeV, I can't get top and bottom quarks, so the heaviest things available are going to be tau and tau neutrino. This is fortunately something that people were already looking for very eagerly at LEP. This is this overlaps with a search for staus, supersymmetric partner of the tau. And we can apply those bounds very robustly because the cross-section is large. So the statement is that basically these charged mesons have to be heavier than 90 GeV or so. They have to be heavier than they could have been made at what?
Why can't you get BV bar?
Charged.
Oh, they're charged.
They're charged.
You have to get BC.
You can get charm strange. I think BC should be suppressed by CKM. You can get charm strange. I think it happens about 20 to 30% of the time. This is much easier to look for.
They charge why they couldn't emit photons in the universe before. Pi plus, pi minus.
There are certainly bounds on having abundance of charged guys in the universe. They have to be unstable. on very short timescales. I mean, it's saying that I can see them in the collider is saying they're unstable on very, very short timescales. So there's no abundance left. Okay. So this gives us a bound which is more model dependent on the actual dark matter itself, this baryon that we want to be the dark matter candidate, which is going to be at least a few times heavier. And so basically these candidates have to be sort of heavier than 200 to 300 GeV or so just from this bound. And it's something we can improve upon in principle by going to the LHC. You can look for instead production of top and bottom pairs for heavier versions of this. Or for diboson decays or things like that. That's sort of an active area of research, so I won't go into it too much. But there are prospects to improve this bound. Okay. I'll say one thing about indirect detection, because it's sort of neat. But indirect detection in this model is sort of a hard problem. Very hard in this context. So even in QCD, the problem of annihilation of two baryons at very low energies is pretty difficult. It happens to be very technically difficult to handle on the lattice, so it's something we don't have a great handle on, and we want the signature of two of these baryons, dark baryons, annihilating into something. And what we know in QCD is that at very low energies, you actually get a pretty complicated final state. So if I draw from the crystal barrel experiment a study of proton-antiproton annihilation, just the fraction of final states that you get, there's actually a pretty wide distribution, and the peak is about 5 pions. This is a highly non-perturbative process, pp bar to 5 pions. It's hard to know exactly how to model this in some generic model. And some other strongly coupled models. So this is difficult to get a handle on, but potentially pretty interesting. And the reason I was drawing those complicated indirect detection signatures on the board before, it would be interesting to consider sort of generally the implications of 2 to n annihilation for those sorts of searches.
So these are pions or pairs?
These are pions.
And
30
minutes?
It's order 30% of all final states give 5 pions. It's a mixture that add up to be charge neutral, right? Because it's pp bar annihilation. There's one other possibility, which I don't want to be completely pessimistic about, indirect detection. And this is something which needs further work. But as I said, we're in a model where all the states have excited states, and I've been sort of emphasizing these pions and these sort of charged variant excited states. But the dark matter candidate itself, the baryon, could have neutral excitations, so just excitations of the internal degrees of freedom. So states that have exactly the same quantum numbers that are split slightly in mass. And you could imagine a transition from that state back to the ground state in the universe could give you some gamma ray lines. In fact, you probably expect several of them, since this is a complicated sector with a bunch of states in it. This is easier to study on the lattice as well, but it's not clear yet what the prospects are for a viable signal here, so there's more work to do. Okay. I can finally come to something I have more to say about in detail, which is direct detection. One of the more straightforward things to study. So I'm going to focus on Higgs exchange and on electromagnetic form factors. So let me start with Higgs. So the idea is simple, is that, again, the fundamental particles, the constituents in this dark sector, have some coupling to the Higgs. It's very natural for that to happen, because if they have some Yukawa coupling, that will generate a mass for them. As it does for the standard model particles. And if they have some coupling to the Higgs, they'll induce such a coupling for the composite state. So I can write down a version of this direct detection diagram I had before. where I have neutron or proton on one side. I exchange a Higgs, I have some other blob over here. Here's my dark baryon. So this is familiar. The story here is very familiar for anybody who's looked at any other dark matter candidate interacting through Higgs, because now you just have the same thing happening on both sides of the diagram, right? We already have to figure out from the fundamental couplings of the Higgs to the real standard model quarks, what is the coupling to the neutron and the proton? And the Higgs couples to the mass term to the scalar matrix element, so we can write these couplings as matrix elements for the dark matter. I write B, I include the fermion mass, psi bar psi B, is equal to the mass of the baryon times a quantity F. And that gives us the tree-level coupling, essentially, between the Higgs, the leading coupling between the Higgs and the baryon. And I can write something similar for the light quarks down here. So this would give me F, Q.
But in our world, it's not that this term which gives mass to nucleon.
Sorry?
In our world, it's not the term which gives mass to nucleon, because it's mostly associated with gluonic anomaly.
Yes, that's right.
Maybe it's not for important for you, but I mean, in real nucleon, its mass mostly comes not from mass of quarks.
That's true. That you can. It's true, but the Higgs couple. I mean, the Higgs couples directly to the quarks. It doesn't couple directly to the gluons, to the gluonic part of the energy. You can rewrite it. You can essentially integrate out the heavy quarks and write a Higgs coupling to the gluonic condensate inside of the nucleon. I know that's a common way to treat this. It's equivalent, and that's sort of in the details of what I'm writing here.
You want this to be weak, right? Because there hasn't been any direct detection. Well, maybe the signal's a direct detection. But,
sure. Weak is a relative term.
Maybe,
but
maybe the fact that it only couples to the quark mass part is an advantage.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, any coupling through the Higgs is going to be relatively weak. Okay, let me keep going. So I can extract these things non-perturbatively. I can use the lattice to calculate this. It's actually very straightforward. The most straightforward thing I can do is to use the Feynman-Hellman theorem. So the lattice is very good at calculating the masses of things. And I can rewrite this matrix element just by looking at the derivative of the baryon mass with respect to the quark mass. So I do simulations at several quark masses. I extract the slope. I can use that to get this matrix element directly. This is one of the things lattice does best. And now I can tell you what the lattice tells us about this. And it's actually sort of an interesting plot. So I'm going to parameterize this by m pi over mv squared. You don't have to worry about exactly the details of what that quantity is. You can think of it as a proxy for the input fermion mass, so this m psi here. As m psi goes to 0, the mass of the pion goes to 0. This will be close to 1 in the opposite limit. And the vertical axis, I have this quantity FB. And here's the plot. Sort of goes from 0.2 up to 0.6 with some error band. I'm being very loose about this. This is from a series of lattice simulations. And what's remarkable about this is that buried on the real plot that I've taken these lines from, there are simulations of several different theories. So this is SU3 to SU7. And for all of those theories, I calculate the baryon mass, I look at this quantity, and everything lies within this band, essentially. So there's some degree of universality here, which we're getting hints of from the lattice, from calculating this in several different theories. And this sort of bounds exactly what the So if I say that my value for this quantity is going to lie in this band here, that tells me sort of bounds exactly what the direct detection interaction can be. And in fact, if I look at direct detection, I can do a calculation. I'm going to introduce a free parameter, which I'll call alpha, which just tells me the fraction of the contribution to a fermion mass from the Higgs mechanism.
Can I have one quick question?
Yes.
In the case of SU7, the balance state you consider has 7 constituent fermions, right?
Yes.
And you have no problem with extracting its mass from a correlator of 14.
That's not my simulation. That was worked by Tom DeGrand. So you have to ask him about whether
that's
problems
his statement
he had.
That,
but yes, he went as far as SU7. I think beyond that point, it becomes intractably difficult to do all the contractions, as you say.
Okay.
So what is this strange thing I'm defining? It's sort of a formal definition, taking a derivative with respect to the Higgs field. This works out to be YV over YV plus root of 2m. This is a quantity that is equal to 0 if I set the Yukawa coupling to 0. It's equal to 1 if I set this little m, which is a vector-like mass term, to 0. So this quantity interpolates between 0 and 1 and just tells me essentially what fraction of the fermion mass itself is coming from the Higgs mechanism. And I can take this, I take this, and I calculate what a direct detection cross-section from this process would be. And pretty robustly, in this window of mass here, basically, I find that alpha is less than 0.3 or so. So I'm using, you know, quantitative results here, numerical results, and with the caveat that this is for some selection of theories and in a particular range of the parameter space, I can draw a pretty qualitative conclusion here, which is that I cannot have all of the mass generated here from the Higgs mechanism. It has to be some contribution from vector-like terms, from some other mechanism. Just because the bounds from this Higgs interaction become stronger as you... Sorry? Yes, that's right. That one I'd have to tell you offline. That has some dependence on the mass of the baryon that you choose relative to the electroweak scale. I've defined things here in such a way that I can quote a numerical bound like that. And I should say even this has some bound. This is proportional to the square root of the baryon mass over a few hundred GeV or so. So if I make it extremely, extremely heavy, then I can still evade direct detection. No, this is as... That's right, that's the point. Because this is a Higgs interaction, if you make it heavier, you're making the interaction stronger. So actually, you can't evade it in this way.
Sorry, where does this bound come from? Can you agree?
This is a combination of this, so the numerical values for F psi, and the bound I'm quoting is for particular for an SU4 theory, but I showed you that this is sort of equivalent for a range of theories.
The ingredients of the equation
because you don't see the
more solid.
You don't see the direct detection.
This is a bound from not having seen this in direct detection. Yes. Sorry, you were saying?
Maybe you can go over what the ingredients of alpha. So I guess H is the Higgs field.
Yes. So this is the derivative of, this is m psi, so this is this quantity, this is the total fermion mass. I'm saying there are two pieces, one from the vector, like from some vector mass term I write down, one from the Higgs mechanism.
And then why taking that derivative just doesn't give y over square root of 2?
That's right. It must be coming from here. That's right, because there's a Higgs field in there too.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you.
And you said this bound comes from non-observation.
Yeah. This is from the Lux experiment.
Not from that plot. Okay.
Yeah, it's the combination of this plot. So this is a numerical input that you need to calculate that cross-section. It's a combination of this and, you know, this diagram, essentially, and results from Lutz.
So your argument is that if alpha is 1, the whole mass comes from the Higgs magnitude.
The whole mass of the fermions. The baryon still has some contribution from the strong coupling.
And the fermions are in the fundamental representation for all the SU ends.
One of them is in the anti-symmetric representation. It's sort of at the lower edge of the bound.
So if you change that, we would have a different bound. So this is model specific in a sense of
whatever
SU end, but always fundamental.
I've written this twiddle here indicating this is very sort of this is a nebulous bound. It's very far from one. But the exact numerical value depends on which theory I pick in this range from SU3 to SU7.
That's the point. It's not saturating the inequality. So some mass of these fermions has to come outside of Higgs interactions.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
So what? Yeah, another way of putting that is that alpha is related or to imply over on B. Right?
It is. So it does have dependence on that. Alpha, the bounded gets stronger actually as m pi over mv goes to the heavy quark limit. It's about 0.1 in the heavy quark limit in this theory. I can weaken it if I make m pi over mv small enough, so if I make f small enough essentially. But then the price that I pay is that the pion, I have a charge state which is much, much lighter than my dark matter candidate, so the dark baryon has to be very heavy. So the bound is strongest for sort of TeV scale dark matter.
But I guess since you're postulating some whole other sector of dark particles that are some constituents not so dark, the idea that that sector would have some mass-generating interactions that have nothing to do with the standard model, it's not here.
Yes. So this mass term is impossible in the standard model because I don't have the appropriate right-handed fields to connect it to. It would violate electroweak symmetry. But in a new sector and a new dark sector, anything can happen. Yes. All right. Let me go to the second half of what I want to say about direct detection, which will involve the photon. So once again, I can write the interaction I'm interested in of the photon with my baryon. I can characterize in terms of the matrix element, and I can write this as just the electromagnetic current inserted between two baryon matrix elements, and this is going to go as Q mu, but mainly the ingredient I'm interested in is this piece. That's what I was calling the form factor, so that's the momentum-dependent coupling. So this is a vector current. The detailed expression of exactly what's in JMU-EM depends on exactly how I assign the charges, so I've left it a little vague. But again, this is what I'm interested in. So in principle, I can calculate this entire function. I can just go to the lattice and say I want this function as versus Q squared. I can do that. But it's actually more useful to think of it for present purposes in terms of a non-relativistic EFT. And the one sentence statement here is that I'm going to take this, I'm going to expand it, series expand for low Q squared. And the momentum expansion sort of corresponds to having more and more derivatives. So if I do this, I can write down the three leading operators that I find. So B bar sigma mu nu B F mu nu, this is a magnetic moment. I can keep going. The next sort of term I can write down looks like this, B mu D nu B, F mu nu. This is what's called the charge radius. Dimension 6 now. And if I go to dimension 7, I can write down something like, for example, B star B, B mu D nu, now two copies of F. this is a polarizability interaction. Okay. I can take each of these interactions. I can play the same sort of game. I take some input for what the...
The rhythm is so demure menu, actually. This way it's kind of contact interaction, like church radios, because it's proportional to square. Because in this form, it looks like, kind of magnetic field or whatever, but it's actually, it's localized in direction.
Okay. You think I put the deep
in the wrong place? Yeah, second term.
Okay.
Yeah, it's what I mean.
Thank you. So I can place bounds on these things in the same way. I take some value for the form factor calculated from strong coupling. And I compare to direct detection experiment. This gives me the bound roughly, and again, this is combination of lattice. This is in a more specific model. I don't have a nice plot of magnetic moment. This is sort of 10 TeV. 1 TeV if I only have the charge radius, and I'll come back to the third one. So one point to make, of course, these are now interactions through the photon. These will scale in sort of interesting and known ways with respect to the nuclear properties. So if you observe something like this with multiple nuclear targets, you can try to back out exactly that it's a photon interaction after the fact.
Yeah.
M is of order lambda d in my model. So they're roughly the same. And in particular, these properties can vary strongly with what exactly the nuclear target is. The magnetic moment, is about a factor of 16 larger for iodine than it is for xenon, for example. That can be much smaller for other elements. So this is something where you can see a wide range in sensitivity for different targets. So the second bound I wrote down, 1 TeV, really only matters if I can get rid of the first bound, of course. Fortunately, it's pretty easy for me to imagine a theory where I have a dark matter candidate like this that has no magnetic moment. And that's if B is spin 0, then there's no magnetic moment interaction I can write down. And I'm down to the charge radius. I can then ask the question, can I keep going? Is there some symmetry I can identify that will eliminate the charge radius for me? I should go on to say, when will this be true for a baryon? If I have an SUN theory with n even, I have an even number of fermions, I get a bosonic baryon. It will tend to be spin 0 in the ground state.
That's it.
Am I running out of time?
Yes.
Okay.
We can try to wrap it up so you can have time for questions.
Let me
see about 6 more pages on your notes.
I always overprepare. Okay. You can look in our paper. I assure you that there's a way to get rid of this. You can identify a discrete symmetry that will kill it, and that brings us down to the polarizability. And this bound is much weaker. This is sort of order 300 GeV. Based on current experiment, this can go in the future to about a TeV with the best direct detection experiment you can imagine before you run into a background cosmic neutrino floor, which you can't really get around. So this is, if you have dark matter that only interacts through polarizability, it's very hard to see. The last point I will make, there was one other qualitative result that the lattice tells us about the polarizability interaction, which is that for n even versus odd, there's no significant difference. So we compared SU3 to SU4, and we find the polarizability about the same magnitude. And you could have argued before the fact that maybe it would be suppressed for even NC because the fermions would pair up and give you a smaller polarizability. That is not the case from lattice, and so you have this sort of robust qualitative result, or at least a hint for it, from the lattice out that this is not suppressed for even n baryons. The other result was that curve that I showed you. And there's lots of interesting work and open questions, but I guess I'll take those from you. So, thanks.
Luke?
So if there's a whole new sector, does that also include forces for which we are charge neutral?
It could easily, yes. So, I mean, for example, the strong force that's binding these things together, I'd assume that we're neutral under that. So that's a new gauge interaction. So that would give strong interactions between these dark matter states themselves, for example.
So then the whole dark matter sector can have also structures like all the way up to atoms, planets, stars, etc.?
Yeah, I didn't get into it in this talk, but there's been also some interesting lattice work on how ubiquitous the formation of nuclei is. So in SU2 gauge theory instead of QCD, there's good evidence that you also form nuclear states. So it may be that very generically in these theories you form dark nuclei if you have this sort of state. And then going farther than that up to atoms and stars and things is completely speculative. So far there's nothing to make atoms in this model. You'd have to have that.
But that would have an astronomical signature, right? Dark matter, stars. Dark aliens.
Stars.
Yeah, it would. I'm not an astrophysicist, so I can't tell you offhand what the signature would be. But
in your introduction, you did not mention axionic dark matter. Is that a dead topic?
I don't think it's dead, but that was not what I wanted to talk about.
I wonder, you know, when we were talking about this annihilation of two dark matter to say kind of the simplest fallacy I can think about, let's say that they annihilate into two photons, right? Because then it gives you a line, right? I wonder, you know, is it kind of a realistic limitation from, you know, because it would be, you know, kind of a very special case, right? Having photonic line of large energy.
That's something good to look for, I think, generically in all kinds of dark matter models. Certainly you could look for it in these models. In particular models that I've looked at this in, the branching ratio into two photons versus, say, two B quarks is very small, is sort of highly suppressed. Yeah, so it's difficult to find.
Yeah, but look, in principle, your dark matter could be the one which does not interact with anything besides gravity, right? Then none of the signal would be around. But it would be enough for your evidences of existence of dark matter, right? This gravity interaction, right? So it's not excluded. No, I just wonder your opinion. So it's not excluded that dark matter does not interact at all with standard.
It's not excluded. I don't know how you would even go on to exclude that.
But you can show it has self-interactions.
You show it has self-interactions?
Because simply the relic density is why we argue against it.
Right.
Then you just would say that's coincidence. It's
meaningless. Go back to the question about whether there's a whole dark chemistry, dark biology, dark finance. we usually assume that the dark matter is pretty much a gas, but doesn't large scale structure inform that assumption?
The microlensing surveys that were done for that reason. They didn't find any unusual objects.
So if you don't see any dark solar systems out there.
Yeah, not yet. All right.